Good morning. In the last 6 or 7 weeks, I've tried to address a few thoughts that have recently been brought to my attention, you might say. One of those was, what about my past and all the sins I've committed in my past? The other is, I would ask you the simple question, what would you say if someone said you have to be perfect to correct anyone? How would you respond to that? And then also, a third lesson, I tried to address what I hear so often and people talking about how much they sin. Christians just seems like they sin all the time, daily, multiple times a day, it seems, not once a month. Or and so in addressing these statements or these things that have been brought to my attention, I talked about the subject of righteousness and holiness and purity and being perfect. And I see that those are all synonymous to one another. In fact, you'll see if you go and look up the definitions that they crisscross quite often. And in addressing that, certainly there are some expectation that I have on the part of the hearer to balance things out, you might say. And when I say I'm perfect, aren't you perfect? That I am certainly not saying in and of myself. And I wouldn't expect that that would be on your end either. But that we have perfection in Jesus Christ. And I addressed in those portions, if you will, of those lessons, how it sounds quite arrogant to say, I'm righteous, I'm holy. And so the plan was to also address humility. And I certainly want to do that this morning. And then Brandon Klein has to get up a couple of Wednesdays ago and bring an excellent talk on humility. And so I text him and said, I am not trying, you know, to one-up you or to whatever. I don't remember how I worded it. I did not say that. But anyways, he says, no, there's not a problem at all in you bringing a lesson on humility. So I want to express this lesson in such a way that we understand what humility is. We're going to see evidence, if you will, signs of humility. But that doesn't take away from the fact of who we are and whom we serve and the confidence that we have in Him. And I do not believe for one second that Joshua and Caleb were arrogant and saying, they are our bread. Let's go. And so when we are in conversation with others, we're not walking around going, I'm righteous, I'm holy, I'm pure, I'm perfect. We're certainly not doing that, but at the same time, we should be, not because of what we have done, but to the glory of God. You know, one day He's going to say, these are my people. When we are gathered together with Him, and in a sense, it sounds like He's going to gloat over what He has done for us, what He has done with us. That it's never about us, but that it's always about Him. And that you and I still fail from time to time, even in our perfection, even in our righteousness. We still struggle from time to time, but the point I was trying to make is that in correcting one another, guess what? We're never going to be perfect in the sense that we do not have any faults of our own. But that doesn't stop us from trying to help someone. You get the beam out of your eye so you can get the splinter out of someone else's. And also that you would have the confidence when you take your last breath, not in yourself, but in the Lord's promise. that you've been faithful to Him. That as Paul says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Therefore, there is laid up for me a crown of righteousness. Does he say that arrogantly? I don't believe so. I think that that's the confidence that he has in God and keeping his promises. Because of how we've lived our lives. I want you to have that kind of confidence. Not an arrogant confidence in the sense that you cannot lose your salvation by any means. But that we live our lives completely devoted. We're not sinning every day. We're not sinning every week. We're not sinning every month. Hey, you think about the guy that's fighting drunkenness. Is he fighting very hard if he gets drunk every day? Is he fighting very hard if he gets drunk every week? Is he fighting very hard if he gets drunk every month? Or do we go, oh. You know, in sobriety, it starts all over. You can be sober for 10 years and ruin it in one moment, right? And it starts the clock all over again in that sense. And so one of my aspirations is that it would be longer and longer and longer from the time that we sin for the next time. And not that we just, you know, no one's perfect. We all sin. Everybody does it. So therefore, well, here we go. Not that we would have pride, ever have pride. And we'll see that as we go through this lesson. If anyone tells you that a certain person speaks ill of you, this is by Epictetus. Long ago, he says, if anyone tells you that a certain person speaks ill of you, do not make excuses about what is said of you, but answer, quote, he was ignorant of my other faults, else he would not have mentioned these alone. So when we talk about being perfect, when I talk about being perfect, I'm not talking about being perfect in and of myself. And it doesn't mean by any means that I'm not going to fail in the next moment. But that my perfection is in God. By His grace, His mercy, His love for me, through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. That's my only hope. We always need to understand our condition and need for God. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 3, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That we need God at every moment. Pride, we'll go through the list of pride and then the list of humility here. Some things that I found that I found interesting. Pride focuses on others' failures. They see the fault of others, but they don't see their own faults, if you will. It's a self-righteous, which we'll address at the end of this lesson, overly critical in fault-finding, always finding fault in the other person. They always see, well, it's evident, like a sore thumb. It looks at the life, or it looks at their life through a telescope, but others with the microscope. You know, they see their life very far from any error. But everybody else, boy, they see the most minute things that are amiss in their lives. Another evidence or sign of pride is that it looks down on those who aren't as spiritual or committed as they are. That idea that because of what I do, because of how I help others, or my practice every day and so on, we look down on others. It thinks they know who is truly proud and truly humble. They become judges of all. And then last, thinks everyone is privileged to have their involvement. Humility realizes how far they fall short and have overwhelming sense of their need to grow. Humility is compassionate and forgiving. It looks for the best in others, gives them the benefit of the doubt. Again, not quick to be critical. It seeks to win people, not arguments. It realizes only God knows a person's true motives. We've addressed that in times past in the sense that someone walks past you and they kind of bump your shoulder and they just keep on going. They don't say that they're sorry. You know, they didn't say hello. And you think, what is wrong with it? But they just found out that a loved one died. You know, they just got bad news. They're in their own world. They didn't even know you existed at that moment, right? We've all had those times of being, you know, the blind spots, if you will. We weren't out to hurt anyone. It's just the circumstance at the moment. And so there was no motive to be rude or hateful. It leaves the judgment of the heart in God's hand. It thinks that they don't deserve the opportunities that God gives them. Which is just the opposite of being bitter. Bitter is the idea that I deserve better than what I have right now. Therefore, I'm going to be sour about it. There was a rider on horseback that came across a corporal, finely dressed, barking out orders to these men who were doing their best to get this large timber out of the ditch. And they could almost get it, but not quite. And along came a stranger on a horse. And he rides up on the situation and he sees the struggle of these men. He sees how the corporal is barking out these orders, but not helping. And so he gets off his horse. And he goes down to the men. He asks the corporal, "You going to help?" "Me? I don't think so." And so that man says, on my command, heave. And so he gets down in the mud and he grabs a hold of that timber with the rest of the men. And he says, "All right, men, heave." And they pull the timber up out of the ditch and it's placed where it needs to be. The man quietly walks over. He gets back on his horse and he turns back to the corporal and says, "The next time you need a piece of timber for your men to handle, corporal, send the commander in chief." Their eyes open and they realize that the man upon the horse is George Washington himself. The President of the United States is willing to get down into the mud. And that is the type of God that we serve. Turn over to Hebrews chapter 2. We've heard it so many times we possibly just take it for granted. The other side of that coin is that none of us have ever been in the presence of God. And if we were, our concept of who God is would completely change, I'm convinced, even though I can't prove it until it happens. But Jesus made himself a little lower than the angels. In Hebrews chapter 2, beginning in verse 9, and we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the author of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified, that is, being set apart, are all of one. For which reason, he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare your name to my brethren. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing praises to you. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, here I am and the children whom God has given me. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shares in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Jesus came to this earth, bled and died. We've heard it so many times. Does it really have an impact on our ears anymore? Well, it should. That the God of glory would come to this place and to suffer like he did for his creation. And you've heard me make that comparison. Would you die for a cockroach? Of course not. We wouldn't die when given the thought process, the true decision. Not that no one's ever given their lives for a pet or for an animal. People have died in such circumstances. But given the opportunity to reason and go, okay, does the horse die or you? They're going to go, the horse is going to die. God says, no, I'll die for the horse. And so what we see out the gate, you might say, when it comes to humility, is a life of submission. A life of sacrifice. A life of giving to others. If God, notice over in James chapter 4 and verse 7, therefore submit to God, resist the devil and he'll flee from you. We submit our all to God. It is who we are. And wives to husbands, in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 18, wives, submit to your own husbands as is fitting in the Lord. The older to the younger, in fact, all to everyone. In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 5, likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And then we would see in the towards the government in 1 Peter 2 and verse 13, therefore submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king is supreme, and he goes on in that context. It's the idea that we are not a rebellious people, not to God, not to one another, not within the family, not in the government or towards the government. We submit. And it is certainly a sign of humility. Another evidence of humility is a willingness to learn. H. Jackson Brown Jr. says, every person that you meet knows something you don't. Learn from them. Now that could be good and bad. But there's always something to learn. When we think we've learned it all, it was one of the primary reasons I left a congregation not too long ago, and that they didn't want any lesson material. They didn't want any accountability, you might say. Just show up and talk about the Bible and go home. Talk about what they've always believed, it seemed to me. They'd already reached that plateau. They couldn't really go any further. And that's a bad, bad place to be. So we're always willing to learn. We ought to be like a little child in Matthew chapter 18, beginning in verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Even his own apostles struggled with this thought of power and authority. Then Jesus called a little child to him, sat him in the midst of them and said, assuredly I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And what we see in a child is that they rely on, they trust, they submit, they follow, they respect, they love their parents until they're around 14 or so, right? until they know it all. Until they stop trusting. Until they want to spread their wings. Until they start rebelling. Can we do that at 65? Yes. We can do that to one another. We can do that to God. We can allow authority to go to our heads, our position, our place. I remember talking to someone years ago, and the response was, "I've been a member here for 40 years. She was going to put me in her place because of how long she had been at that congregation. As if that really, you know, her rank had something to do with her sinfulness. And so therefore, since she'd been there for 40 years and she'd only, you know, been a sinner for her. Anyways, I think you get the point. If I can't learn from an 8-year-old when I'm 80, then I probably shouldn't take another breath. We can learn from one another. It is certainly a sign of humility. We need to be open to criticism and correction. I've dealt with that enough already, but it needs to be put in. It's amazing how quickly our pride bubbles up when someone's going to correct us. So I want to approach it in a little different way. We're certainly not going to just go, okay, I talked about that 2 weeks ago, I'm out of here. Turn over to Exodus chapter 18 with me, please. This is an excellent example of possibly in a situation where Moses is not in fault, okay? He's not wrong in how he is judging the people. Certainly his judgment is not in question. Just the practice, how it comes about that he's killing himself. And his father-in-law has a little compassion on him. So in Exodus chapter 18 and verse 13, here's the problem. And so it was on the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. So he is judging the people all day, every day. It's never going to end because there are too many people with too many problems that he has to address. And so in verse 14, he questions his father-in-law. Notice, so when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit and all the people stand before you from morning until evening?" So Jethro is asking this question, how is this? How did this come about? Why are you doing this? What is the reasoning? In essence. So in verse 15 and 16, Moses gives his answer. And Moses said to his father-in-law, "Because the people come to me to inquire of God. When they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws." So he is the judge. So Jethro has some advice for him. Now, I want you to understand that people can give us advice all the time. They can criticize us all the time. They can correct us. They can rebuke us, instruct us. And we should be open to all of those. But Moses could be this individual, and of course we know that he's the most meek person. But he could be like, I think I've got this under control. I've been doing this for a while. I know what I'm doing here. He could have bowed up. He could have resisted. He could have told Jethro, "You just take care of your business and I'll take care of mine." So in verse 17, so Moses'
father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you do is not good." Now he asks, "Why are you doing this?" Moses gives his explanation, and Jethro just pretty much goes straight to the point. Yeah, that's not good. You think Jethro's wrong? Oftentimes it's how we respond to the criticism. It's the spirit we want sometimes, the confrontation. We say you don't want confrontation, but then when it arises, boy, we're not quick to run the other way. Oftentimes we escalate rather than taking the punch, if you will. That's a punch right there. The thing that you do is not good. Is he doing anything wrong? He's not doing anything wrong. Moses is not sinning. But he's killing himself by doing what he's doing. So, Jethro says, "The thing that you do is not good." Verse 18. "Both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourself out. For this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself. Listen." So he's going to give him some advice. "Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel." And I love this qualifier. "And God will be with you. Stand before God for the people so that you may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness," there shouldn't be no bribing going on, in other words, "and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people all the times. Then it will be that every great matter that they bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you, for they will hear the burden with you. If you do this thing," and I love this, "and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all of this people will also go to their place in peace." Now Moses might think he has everything under control. Moses might also have responded, "Who are you to tell me what to do?" Right? Copping an attitude. "I've been doing this for such and such period of time. And how can I trust these others?" Or he could have responded in such a manner that I've seen in others too, and I've even felt it myself. You throw up your hands and go, "Fine, you do it," and walk off. There was a couple of sisters who had fixed the Lord's Supper many, many times. It's in the middle of summer, and they would do it the Saturday morning before, and by Sunday morning, the fruit of the vine was a little rank. You know, the AC didn't kick on and so on. I didn't ever see any fuzz, but it didn't taste right. And when something was said to them about it, guess what they said? "Well, never prepare the Lord's Supper again." Great attitude. Great attitude. Moses could have responded in such a manner. "Fine, you judge the people. I'm going on vacation. See you later." But in verse 24, "So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said." Might be a good way to approach it. We need to understand we are God-made, not self-made. Humility is always grateful. In 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 10 and 11, as each one has received a gift, minister it to one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. If anyone speaks, let him speak as the oracles of God. If anyone ministers, let him do it as with the ability which God supplies. That in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belong the glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. So the rub comes in Luke 18, verses 9 through 14, when it comes to us stating our confidence, if you will, in God and our reassurance, and that we would stand and we would proclaim that we are the only true church. Would you say that? Is it found in the Bible that someone ever stands up and says, I'm the member of the only true church? No. Not in those words. But when we read about these passages in Luke 18, 9 through 14, and the tax collector would not even look up, but beat his breast and says, God be merciful to me, a sinner. We might run to that passage and think that there's no room for us to say that we have confidence in God to save me in my last hour. In fact, it says in verse 9, also he spoke this parable, Jesus spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. See, that's the opposite of humility. They're not God-made, nor is this Pharisee humble to exalt others above himself. So two men went up to pray. One a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. That's pretty brazen, right? I fast twice a week. I give tithes to all of all that I possess. Look how fortunate you are to have me. And of course, in verse 14, I tell you, this man went down to his house justified, and that is the tax collector who said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner, rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. You see, he didn't trust in God. He was self-righteous, and therefore he despised others. So when we find ourselves looking down on others as if, you know, I would never. How could they? We're in trouble. When we think that we're doing it because of how righteous we are, and I haven't sinned in such and such time. Although that may be a goal, and that's our pursuit, to become more sanctified as time goes by. That I'm actually repelling against evil. And I'm getting further away from it, not becoming more numb to it. And so in Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 24, a proud and haughty man, scoffer is his name. He acts with arrogant pride. We have to be careful about that. We can't classify ourselves with others. I don't have that one up there. It's 2 Corinthians 10 in verse 12. For we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves, but they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise. And finally, we have to be a servant. Of course, to God in Hebrews 12 and verse 28, therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Let us have grace, unmerited favor. And you've heard me say that in that last day, if God were to send me to hell, I'd say that's what I deserve. But I trust in the blood of Jesus Christ that that will not be the case. Much is said about this in Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. And we're to be like-minded. We have the mind of Christ, who did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a servant, and coming in the likeness of men. He humbled himself to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Now God has highly exalted him. And so it should be with us, that we give our lives completely to the Lord. And one day we will be exalted to His glory. And I would encourage you to look at, I don't have it on the list there, but in Luke 17, verse 7, in that when it's all said and done, we are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do. We're still just filthy rags. But on the other hand, we've been cleansed by the blood of the Lamb. We're made white by His blood. And so James and John wanted to sit on either side of Jesus when He came into His kingdom. In Mark chapter 10, I am going to go ahead and read that, or at least just a couple of verses there. In Mark chapter 10, verses 42 and 45, the whole context begins in verse 35, but Mark 10, 42 through 45, but Jesus called them to Himself and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever of you desires to be first shall be a slave of all. For even the Son of Man," here's the perfect example, "did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life a ransom for many." You remember when Jesus is washing the apostles' feet and He comes to Peter, and Peter says, "You ain't gonna wash my feet." And we might call that humility, but it was kind of a false humility, you might say, in the sense that Jesus says, "If you don't let me wash your feet, you have no part of me." I know we have a different culture, but if we were to say Tuesday night at 7 p.m., we're going to come together and we're going to wash one another's feet, would there be any fault in that? The question is, what would hinder you from showing up? Would you be the one washing, or would you be the one being washed? Would you do both? Or would you say, "No, you're not going to wash my feet"? And that sends that false humility that, "No, no, I'm not worthy." Could be true. That's pretty much what John the Baptist said in regard to Jesus. "I'm not worthy to loosen the straps of His sandals." But would you come? Would you come to wash everybody's feet? But no, you're not going to wash mine. Think about it. Who cares about the culture? That's the world anyways, right? We can create our own culture within the Lord's body. I know we don't have dirty feet in the sense that they had dirty feet back then, but give that some thought. It is a life of submission, a willingness to learn, an openness to criticism and correction. We realize that all our talents and abilities are God-given. We are who we are because of God, not because of ourselves. That we'll be a humble servant before Him, willing to stoop as low as we have to serve others. No comparison to what Jesus did, the Word becoming flesh and dwelling among us. what an example to follow. If we can help you be committed, then we would encourage you to come as we stand and sing.
Not must we go by the way of the cross, there's no other way but this. I shall make